I'm going to give you a few minutes to look at what I handed out before we start, but I just wanted to start with a reminder and then ask a question here. I'm convinced that we can see the Dharma every place if we're awake and we actually want to. You know, the more that we're awake, we can see it, but we have to train ourselves to see it and to watch. So I have a question, and the question is when the telephone went off, okay? I want to know if anyone had a reaction other than annoyance. Okay, all right. So what was the reaction?
It was amusing.
It was amusing.
Okay. I smiled.
Okay. Was there any imagery or anything?
Yes, somebody in the back, but I couldn't hear it going like this to get their phone.
Okay, all right.
What? I don't know.
Maybe a marimba or something. I was just imagining
okay.
a wooden instrument.
Okay, and that was just spontaneous, right? Yeah, just, okay. Anything else?
It brought up the remembrance of when Steve Armstrong was here and Gillette's phone went off over there, and he pointed that out as a teaching moment.
Okay. So in these two cases, there was an image. In your case, there was a recollection.
Yeah, there was probably first an image, then the recollection.
And a recollection, right. And that was spontaneous. It wasn't intentional.
No, it just happened.
Just happened, okay.
So I had an initial sanya, like an initial perception. That was a new kind of bell. I was like, whoa, yeah, this is ringing a new kind of bell.
Okay. Anything else?
I said to myself, I was drifting off a little bit. Well, now I'm awake. It was like being in a Zen group when you have the teacher come by.
Okay, all right. Okay, so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what happened to me, too.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else?
Well, especially because you just said something about it, and so I started thinking about, oh, how funny you just said that.
Yeah. So this is like, okay, well, you say, well, kind of a throwaway event, right? But part of what we're going to be talking tonight is this model of a traditional model of how you learn in Buddhist practice. And one of them is reflection, you know, reflecting on an event, and the other one is seeing it while it's occurring. But you know, there's the sound, right, which in this case was the phone that hits an eardrum, and from a Buddhist perspective, what immediately happens, there's three things that happen almost simultaneously or simultaneously. Okay, so one is, what's the first thing?
Yeah.
Consciousness arises. Okay, so there's the raw recognition of sound. Okay, and then the next thing that happens is a perception, which from a Buddhist perspective is this inherent and automatic ability of the mind to hear or see something, and not through thought, but instantaneously categorizing it into something that's familiar to make sense of it. So, you know, somebody... You know, there's a marimba, or there's, you know, a new, or whatever it is, right? I mean, just instantaneous. And then the other thing that happens is that there's a feeling tone to it, right? A pleasant, unpleasant, or neither of those two. A lot of people call that neutral. I don't think it's neutral. I think it's something other than neutral. But depending on how strong that is, that escalates up to something stronger than just this initial impression of pleasance, and you know, you're talking about you're kind of holding back a giggle, right? So, you know, for me, what happened was I heard that, and instantaneously, what it reminded me of was the sound of that they would make while a contestant was waiting to answer a question. During a 1950s quiz show that I haven't thought about probably since the 1950s, and I didn't like to begin with. You know, like, I mean, it's fascinating that that's stored, right, someplace in there, and just instantaneously the mind links that association. And then it seemed so preposterous to me that I was having trouble not laughing. You know, it was like, my reaction was one of, so this seems like a pretty mundane, harmless illustration, but think of what we're trying to do with practice. And rather than an initial reaction like this of humor or a memory, that it's a spontaneous reaction like that involving imagery or thought or feeling of fear or trauma or whatever it may be. And that's what this practice is striking at. I mean, we're actually talking about retraining that. This is extraordinary, what we're attempting to do. You know, we're talking about literally restructuring and retraining the fundamental operation of the mind. So, I mean, those little incidences for me are, you know, if I just sit with it even for a minute and reflect on it, is such a deep reminder of what we're trying to do and how challenging it is and why the Buddha said that this is a training that requires some diligence. You know, we're not going to reprogram that by randomness. You know, it requires a certain level of dedication. So I would like you to take a look at, for a minute, the handout that is entitled Components of Buddhist Learning, Developing a Sense of Where You Are. I'm going to give you a minute to kind of look at that, and then we'll dig in. Okay. So, Sarabella, it's not too late to, if you want to give the talk. So, okay, all right. All right. So this talk is the second in a series that is having kind of a little bit of a changing focus in response to comments that I got from my last talk and some emails. This talk is entitled Developing a Sense of Where You Are, and it's about how we find what the path is and when we're confused. Because teachings seem to be contradictory, or that were lost in a forest of suffering and can't find the path, how to find our way out. Okay. So what I'd like to start with is a brief story about a basketball player in the late 50s and early 60s, a time when basketball was still a team sport primarily and wasn't about show and ego. I mean, it was about collaboration and teamwork, and there was this high school player in, I think, 1957, 1958, and when he graduated from high school, 70 different United States colleges recruited him and offered him scholarship. This is back in the 60s now. Okay, he ended up going to Princeton, you know, hardly a basketball power, and ended up breaking just about, you know, every record that existed. What he was known for was, you know, really being a team player, being collaborative, and being really, really modest. And when he graduated from college, he was offered all kinds of contracts from pro teams, and he turned them all down to be a Rhodes Scholar with England, and came back, and eventually he did play in the pros for a while. And you may know him, you may remember him, if you're something close to my age, as Senator Bill Bradley. Okay. It's pretty unusual for a college student basketball player to have a book written about him within 2 years of graduating from college. You know, it's a kind of extraordinary thing. And this is the book, and it's called A Sense of Where You Are. And this was written in 1964. Okay, and you can see it's like, it looks like it was written in 1964, is it? So, but what this book is about is about him as a person, and about him as a player, his discipline and his training. And where this title comes from is one unusual thing about him is he had a shot that he would make where he would, it's kind of like a Michael Jordan or a Michael Jackson video, you know, where somebody throws the ball over their shoulder and it goes in the basket. You know, we've all seen those. Well, Bradley actually had a shot that he would shoot left-handed, right-handed, not looking at the basket that he would shoot, and had this extraordinary high percentage of making that shot, you know. And since then, you know, early 1960s to today, there's never been a player in college or in the pros who has ever done that. You know, you'll see people occasionally do that, and you'll see, you know, a lot of trick shots, but you'll never see anybody have a shot like that, not looking at the basket and consistently make it and being a staple. I mean, like, that was one of the things he did. And in his time, no one considered this like showing off or a trick shot. Everybody was just couldn't understand it. You know, they couldn't understand how he could consistently do that. So when John McPhee was writing this book, he interviewed him and spent a lot of time and asked him about this shot. So they went out on the court, he's trying to get him to explain the shot to him, how he does it. So they're moving around the court in different locations while he's being interviewed. And while he's being interviewed, he's shooting from different locations. And, of course, all of them go in, right? So his explanation for this was that after he played ball for a while, he had a conceptual and mental and then a bodily image, a feeling for the map of the court and that at any given time he had a sense of where he was, which allowed him to shoot without looking and to pass without looking. And this was another thing about him. You know, you'll see pro ball now, you'll see all of these. Somebody's looking this way and shoots that way. He would just do that all the time. Now, they found out that he had an unusual range of vision. Okay? But it wasn't big enough to explain either of these two things, you know. So this idea of having a map in your mind that then becomes intuitive because you've trained yourself, and as a result you have a sense of where you are in relationship to other people, and in this case the basket, was profound for me. Because I thought it was at the core of fundamental learning. And once I got into Buddhist practice, although nobody ever worded it like that, that's how I've understood the practice, is that the reason, you know, that we do study and training and retreats and all of this is that we're developing this sense of the larger, you know, we call it a path, but this larger map of the elements of practice, and that as we mature at any given point, we begin to develop a sense of where we are in relationship to teachings, in relationship to the path, how things begin to fit together. And if we have that, even if we're confused, we've got a starting place to try to find our way. So, you know, it's like you're lost in a forest. The figuring out how to get out of the forest starts before you ever enter it. It starts with either having a physical map or a mental map, and then having a sense of where you are in this terrain, and then having a series of tools to find the path out. So for me, it's an image, an idea, whatever you want to call it, of how we develop practice. It was fascinating for me to later find a sutta of the historical Buddha that talks about a practitioner developing a sense of the Dharma. And it's pretty much the same thing. And he lays out a series of criterions of what that means, but it's basically that idea, that through practice we begin to develop, first of all, an idea of how we practice. So, well, we know that restraint in the precepts, so we have to, first of all, conceptually realize that in any given moment, okay, I should exercise some restraint here, you know. And then as you do it more and more, it starts to become an intuitive response, you know, just like Bradley, right? I know what to do. I don't have to think about it. So the Buddha actually used the analogy of being lost in a jungle. He said that his coming to the Dharma was being like lost in a dense jungle and it being very difficult to move through the jungle, and coming upon an opening where there was a pristine and beautiful palace, the Dharma, that had been sitting unused and waiting to be discovered. And so really at the very essence, you know, for me that's always been a powerful image, because it conveys the message that this is about discovery. At its very essence, that's, you know, insight is spontaneous discovery. You set up the conditions and insight arises, liberating insight. So it's about discovery, and the amazing thing about it is that what we're discovering is what is already inside of us. You know, the Buddha was very clear that he didn't create the Dharma, is that he was describing a series of principles of causation that the mind and the body and relationships and the world operate on. and that what we needed to do was open to that and discover it in our lives and then allow that to inform our lives. So, the way we do that is setting up the conditions that allow what is already present in us to emerge. And so what these series of talks are about, what I'm hoping they're going to do, is talk about what the map looks like and what the tools are like to work with that. Tonight I'm going to talk about the Buddhist model of learning, and several people asked that I talk about insight and how that relates to this topic. So as a starting place, Steve Armstrong was here recently, and Steve Armstrong's teacher, primary teacher for the last 10, 12, 13 years, has been Ute Janiyah. And Ute Janiyah and a number of teachers, but Ute Janiyah particularly, talks about Dharma practice being similar just to regular education, in the sense that, you know, there's grades that you go through. You know, there's kindergarten and grade school and middle school and high school and college and graduate school and postgraduate, okay? And at each level, our understanding of any given practice or teaching is going to be a little bit different. It's going to mature so that someone who is at the beginning of practice or has been practicing 3 or 4 years is going to have one understanding of the path and its application to their life, and that will probably be different than that same person after they've been practicing for 15 or 20 years. At that point, there have been a whole series of things that have happened, and their understanding is more sophisticated and nuanced. Okay? And the Buddha said that there were basically different styles or capacities for learning. And this may be comforting for some of us, and it may be disappointing for others of us. But he said there are people who learn very quickly and very easily. Okay. You know, they hear the Dharma, they start praying, boom. I mean, they're, and I'm sure you've met those people. You know, it's amazing. He said there's those people who learn very quickly, but it's very hard for them. But because of their determination, because of their aspiration, it continues to be very quick. He said there's then people who learn very slowly. Despite a lot of effort, they learn very slowly, but it's not painful. It's relatively easy. But it just, you know, they just learn slowly and in small amounts. And then he said, and this may sound familiar, or it may sound familiar for certain times of your practice, that there are those people who learn very slowly, and it is very difficult for them. You know? And, you know, in my own case, I kind of sense that that reflects my practice at various periods. You know, some periods you feel like the growth is very quick. Which is kind of deceptive, because it's all dependent on what preceded it, right? You know, and you become ripe, and then all of a sudden, you know, things start to open for you. So it may have seemed very difficult and slow, but it was the precondition to things flowering. So I'd like us to look at this this little chart entitling Components of Buddhist Practice Developing a Sense of Where You Are. And this is a traditional description that I mentioned the other night, but of three fundamental components of practice that should be part of our practice. And so the first one is study. So traditionally that was described as listening, because it was an oral tradition, and you'd hear, you know, now it's reading, you know, the myriad different ways that we can hear and listen to the Dharma. Historically, it involved memorizing the Dharma, suttas, and that was both so they could be passed on, but also it was a learning tool. Because even if you've just tried to learn one of the small suttas or memorize the Metta Sutta, for example, it's quite an amazing experience when you do that. It's totally different than just reciting it. You know, even if you do that regularly, you start to see relationships between ideas and words. You know, why is that particular word used? Why is that particular order used? I mean, it really prompts a lot of reflection. And then historically, in the Sangha, discussion and debate, and particularly in the Tibetan tradition, you know, I mean, they don't call it discussion, they call it debate. So then you hear the Dharma, you consider it, and then you discuss it with people who are on the path at the same level you are. And then the final element was that you would seek confirmation that the understanding that you have is consistent with, quote, you know, the true teachings. And that would be going to a senior monk and saying, you know, we've had this discussion. You know, Jerry thinks this, I think that, Jith thinks that. Which one of us is on the ball here? And the senior monk would say, well, you're kind of all close, but, okay, and here's what it is. And then the suttas are replete with other senior monks, senior members of the Sangha, giving Dharma talks. And then after they're done, people going to the Buddha and say, hey, Sariputta just gave this talk. Was that the true stuff? You know, did he really know what he was talking with? And the Buddha would say, yeah, he was right on. Okay. But the model basically is that part, and you'll see in a lot of suttas, they'll talk about conduct or ways of interpreting things that is basically approved by or is consistent with the view of the elders. And it's basically that the model is that we learn from each other and that we rely on the people who are in front of us on the path to confirm that how we're practicing and how we think we should be practicing and what the teachings mean, that we're actually on the right path. So traditionally that's called learned or conceptual understanding or knowledge. And it includes, and I'm calling it cognitive insight because I want to draw some distinctions, but it includes that you will spontaneously have a realization of how things fit together that you didn't have before. And it's kind of like, it's almost like the discussion we were having earlier about hearing the phone go off. And the mind immediately having a consciousness and a perception and a feeling tone, that you will just spontaneously have a conceptual or intellectual understanding of something. And, you know, in science, there's a lot of scientific discoveries historically. There's a speech I gave last year, year before, that's comparing these things that are spontaneous in this way. So there's listening, reading, memorizing, copying, discussing, confirming, all of which we can do, you know, and all of which are part of the traditional path. That is considered third-hand knowledge. You know, there's direct, and there's reflection, and then so that is, from that by itself, liberating insight does not arise. It is a precondition to liberating insight and experiential insight arising. If you don't have this component, the serious element of this, it is difficult. Yeah, some people can do it, most of us can't. Okay. And I put the Pali terms, if you want to research it, next to each of these components. So the second one is what's traditionally referred to as reflection, which is intellectual or conceptual examination, review, evaluation of a teaching. So it's reflecting, reasoning, thinking, considering the relationship between teachings, how they relate together, which is critical. Comparing that to our experience, so reflecting to, you know, does that match with, does that make sense in my life experience? And then usually that prompts more study, you know, because you start, gee, I wonder, maybe I didn't understand that, or I wonder if, and then you go back, and so it's this very dynamic process. Traditionally, that's referred to as reflective knowledge. It's inquiry based on understanding. And once again, you have this conceptual insight that arises. Because once again, this isn't that you're having an experience, either a meditative experience or a daily life experience, and something is arising from it. This is, the first one is the study of something. The second one is a reflection on it. So both of these are primarily conceptual, intellectual in nature. Okay, and that's considered secondhand. You know, we're getting closer, you know, to direct experience because we're reflecting on our own experience and comparing it to the teachings. But it's still primarily intellectual or conceptual. So the final one practice, you know, traditionally is called spiritual cultivation. And this is about direct, immediate, spontaneous experience, and traditionally we're referring to the act of meditation. Okay, it can also apply to daily life, but the deep insights that are considered to liberate the mind traditionally are considered to arise in meditation, not in daily life. And then the perceptions in meditation inform daily life. Okay. So the characteristics of this is, first of all, the spontaneous nature of it. It doesn't matter how hard you try, you cannot make insight arise. You know, you can't say, okay, you know, this sitting tonight, I'm going to have insight arise about X. Not going to happen, you know. So all the effort is designed to set up conditions and understanding what those conditions are that then allow things to come together and insight to arise from the act of meditation. It's a multidimensional, polysensual in the sense that when you have these, they are clear. You know them to be true. There's no question about it. It's not like an intellectual insight. It's something that you feel in your mind and in your body. Frequently having a very strong feeling in the body. And this whole experience is beyond language or concepts. You know, the best we can do is try to describe it. But as part of what's going to go up on the website, I'm going to include a little essay by Joseph Goldstein about different kinds of insight. And so you have insight from at the simplest level of just think of sometime when you've had a sitting. You sit down, your mind's chaotic, it's all over the place. You just stay with the process, and then all of a sudden, at some point, your body and your mind drops down into this place of consolidated calmness. I can say that, you can try to describe it, but that experience of deep calmness and clarity of the mind is an extraordinary moment of experience. It's not an idea, it's not a concept, it's a thought. And if we can actually recognize that experience, it's a moment of insight into the nature of the mind being calm, of having tranquility, okay? So our ability to recognize this is a key part of the process. You know, we can have it and just go by it. It's like, you know, I had this nice sitting, I was really calm. And so the difference between recognizing it and really appreciating it and not is a question of training the mind to watch for it. Of like, how do we be awake? You know? So that's like the simplest illustration of insight. Liberating insight are larger experiences. And they can be about how we're engaging the world. I'm going to give you an illustration in just a second to try to give you at least the best I can do to describe this. And traditionally, there are insights, spontaneous insights into the constantly changing nature of experience, that's Nietzsche, and the importance of impermanence or constant change isn't that everything is constantly changing. That's the intellectual idea of impermanence. The Buddhist significance of the fact that things are changing constantly is that they are changing constantly based on the conditions that immediately precede them, so that all experience is conditioned, and that all experience is dependent. So my experience right now is conditioned by the moment before in my body and my mind, and it's dependent on it. If you took those conditions away, I would not be having this experience. I would be having a different experience, or I would be having no experience at all. If there were no conditions, I wouldn't be alive, or I wouldn't be conscious. So there are deep experiences into that, and you know, we'll have these in a wide range. You know, you'll have a sitting, and you'll drop into a place, and you'll have the spontaneous experience of recognizing, of realizing, a realization that your anger or your fear or your anxiety or your depression or your joy is changing every moment and dependent and conditioned. And so when you have these small and large, they affect everything thereafter. They affect how we understand the world because they're not intellectual. I mean, it's a whole body, whole mind experience. And then the deeper experiences relate to the fact it's an extension of impermanence, that we see that any given experience or any state of mind or anything we think about ourselves or about the world is conditioned and dependent, so that nothing, doesn't matter what it is not independent, is not isolated, is not separate, and is not permanent, separate and apart from all the conditions. You know, if you take away the conditions, I'm not here. You're not here. You take away the conditions, my mind state is not here. So, you know, traditionally they use language like, you know, no self. We say, well, it's empty of any. But what it means is that we are wholly interdependent. You take that interdependence away, nothing exists. You know, like today there was I have Bing as a, you know, as my browser, and when you hit Bing, it comes up and it has the little boxes and there's a little picture and then it has like three or four words under it, you know, trying to entice you to go to a news story. So it had a picture of the sun that was, you know, very dark and it said something about a solar storm coming. So I opened up and I looked at it and said, well, you know, we're going to get hit with the solar storm tomorrow. And they said, but it's not a big one. You know, we don't have to worry. I mean, so, I mean, like, I really haven't thought about solar storms too much. But it's fascinating. The spontaneous reaction I had was just the idea that, like, well, what if it wasn't a little one? I mean, like, what if it was, like, a big one? And, you know, I wake up tomorrow morning, and that's it. Yeah, just completely beyond my control. And I'm helpless in the universe because my ability to be alive and to be here and to be with you is wholly dependent on the sun. That is one of the conditions, and I am completely and wholly dependent on that. If you take that away, I'm not here. We're not here. So every single thing, every state of mind, every feeling, every emotion, my body, my relationship with you, is conditioned and dependent. So you start having insights into that. You know, interestingly, you know, that that intellectual kind of cognitive insight of, well, gee, if it was a big one, I wouldn't be here, scared the shit out of me, frankly. I'm serious. I mean, like, it is amazing. You know, it's like that just, like, broke through all my normal defenses, and it just terrified me. You know, that we are so vulnerable, you know, and that our mind is protecting us from the vulnerability all the time, you know. And so this discovery idea, you know, that the Buddha said, I'm going through the jungle and, you know, and I discover this open place. You know, we just don't know what's going to happen, and that's what's exciting, and that's what's also fearful, and we've got to try to avoid the denial and open up to the possibility and the beauty of what may happen. And I'm going to give you an illustration in just a minute of a sitting I had. And, you know, you sit down and you're going to have a sitting and you think you're, well, I'm just sitting down to have a sitting. Well, we ought to be sitting down with, you know, an open and curious mind, because in any given sitting, we can have these insights. And so, like, if that's not how we're thinking, if that's not how we're training our mind to see and to be open and to be curious, that's one of the conditions that influences the sitting. It completely changes the energy of the sitting. I mean, if the energy of your sitting is, man, I wonder what may happen. You know, you're sitting one way. If you're sitting like, man, I've really had a tough day, or I've had a tough morning, and well, you know, it's going to be a little different. And we just don't know. The other story that I saw today that really grabbed my mind and I think relates to this is, you know, I wish I had, out of respect, I'm sorry I didn't do it, but I should know his name, and I should know something about him to tell the story. But you know, there was this event, I think, in Florida, you know, the school shooting. You know, there's this man who gets up and thinks he's going to have let me just try to finish this story. Okay. So, you know, there's a man there who got up and thought he was going to have the kind of day we were going to have. And went to school. He's a teacher. And this kid comes in, you know, shooting people. And so he shields a bunch of his students and is shot to death. Man. So, you know, we just don't know, you know, like what life has in store for us. And so this idea that we're supposed to be awake every moment as much as we can. And the reason we want to do that is actually experience this life, to be fully human. And to do that as deeply as we can, because we don't know. Because our life is conditional, is dependent. We don't know when we lose that opportunity, you know. So this is called traditionally, it's alternatively labeled as meditative, experiential, or intuitive insight. And it's not intuitive in kind of a an unclear, nebulous Western sense of, well, I have an intuition about something. It's talking about this experience that arises in through the wisdom of the body and the mind, something that's already there, comes together when it's ripe, and presents itself to us. And it's liberating in small little pieces, and then sometimes quite dramatically, because it penetrates right into the very nature of what experience, our experience as being human, is about. I want to give you just a brief illustration, and then we can talk a little bit about this, of a sitting I had recently. And the only reason I'm doing this is not to use myself as a poster child, because I don't consider that, but at least from my experience, what an experience of insight may look like, because I got a lot of emails and questions about, well, basically, I don't understand what you're talking about. Okay. So I had a sitting recently, and it starts off pretty mundane. I can't sit on the floor anymore because I've had both of my knees replaced, so I sit in the on a couch or a chair, and when it's a little cool like this, I usually have a blanket on, you know, with one shoulder uncovered, and 7 times out of 10, my two Karen Terriers get up, and one lays against one leg, and the other one lays against the other leg, which is very comforting. I start the sitting, you know, the normal thing, just open to the body and what have you, and just immediately see how much energy is in the mind, you know, and not having been clear about that before I started the sitting, you know, so just opening it was like, oh, man, that's just unbelievable, you know, just settling down a little bit, it's all released, and just this flood of images and feelings and emotions, some thoughts, kind of feeling like right on the edge of being out of control, not being very comfortable, and feeling very chaotic. You know, it's not like sometimes you'll have these sittings where there's a lot of energy and you know what it is. You know, it's like, wow, that's anger. You know, whew. You know, I'm just lit up. it wasn't that. It's just like this surge of energy, a lot of images, kind of kaleidoscopic. And so, you know, and I could feel not wanting to be with it. So just setting an intention just to open to it, to try to be curious, and to not hold on to wanting it to be other than it is. Just keep letting go over and over again into the experience that's unfolding. So, I don't know how long. I don't know if it's 10 minutes or 15. It's 45 minutes, but I don't know at what stage. At some point, what starts to appear is seeing quite clearly that there is a piece of the mind that isn't caught up in all this chaotic, kaleidoscopic activity. That there actually is, the mind is settled, and the awareness is quite clear and is beginning to see the distinct parts of all of this jumble of unfolding things. So then, you know, just staying with that, just watching, and pretty soon, you know, the clarity of that part of the awareness holding it is surprisingly balanced. You know, it reflecting on it, like it doesn't make any, almost doesn't make any sense, because the initial impression is that your mind is so disturbed and chaotic. But it's just the energy in the mind, that the consciousness or awareness itself actually is quite stable and can hold it. So you just stay with that, and then pretty soon what starts to unfold is I could see the separate pieces, you know, that an image would come up and I could see what the image was. And I could see the emotion and see that there was an emotion related to that image, and there was a feeling tone, and then what slowly started to emerge was a feeling that all of this had a common theme. That they weren't random, it wasn't chaotic, that in fact they were all related. And then just staying with that, what after some period of time, and once again, none of this is thought. It's just this experience in the body that later you're trying to describe. What finally emerged was this very, very clear feeling that there was a common thing that was driving all of these images. And all of the images and feelings had to do with aversion, frustration, anxiety, anger. They're all in that neighborhood. And that they were all linked to the mind in each one of these images, wanting things to be a certain way that it wasn't, and fighting against it, resisting it. Just like so clear, it was unbelievable. And, you know, something that I had not recognized or that my mind had put together before the sitting. So I could see that there were these discrete elements of my life right now, experiences that I was having. I was having the same underlying experience, and they were all being driven by the same thing, by this attachment. And then the attachment was driving the identification and the negative emotions. And then that was basically the end of the sitting. Okay, so it didn't have the elements of seeing how transitory it was or how impermanent it was. Okay. So, but after the sitting, I just sat there with it, and it was just like so clear that there was this undercurrent of this whole set of experiences in my life and why they were occurring, which I was confused about before. And then the other thing that was just so clear that, you know, you just reflect on it a little bit, the second element, reflect on your experience, is like, was just really clear. I mean, like, in my future sittings, focusing on the anicca anatta, the changing, non-isolated aspect of this, was going to be important part of my work. that was an extension of this experience. And the second one was, is it identified for me some real life situations where I need to do some personal work. So for me, this is an illustration of how these components of study, reflection, and practice end up producing this kind of experiential insight, and then that experiential insight informs your life and directs your practice and directs what you're going to do in your life. Okay, does that work? So that's I think I'm going to stop there. And I'm just going to say that I'm going to give a couple of more talks, and they're going to be about, well, what does the map look like? You know, this was like, how do we study? Well, what would you study? And I'm going to try to lay out, it's part of what's on the back here. There's the four foundations, but that's part of the map. So, and there's going to be three or four different parts that I'm going to go with. And my thesis is that if we, that is the map that, that's the equivalent to Bill Bradley's map of the court, or the Buddha's map in the jungle of finding the opening. That if we, even if we don't know it in detail, if we know those things, that they will guide our practice, particularly when we're confused, that there we will have a direction to go. Like, what questions do I ask? How does this relate to the map? Okay, so... Okay, so thoughts, questions?
Your story about the solar storm, one translation of anicca is uncertainty. It's terrifying to, if you actually cognitively look into the sort of radical contingency of our existence, right? Particularly if you're a parent. How is that liberating?
So. Good question, and I think this has a lot to do with what are we focusing on, okay? Because the liberating part is that if in fact it's true, and we just find that out from our experience, if it's true or not. But if it's true that everything is contingent and dependent, that means that the worst thing that we believe about ourselves, you know, whatever that is that everybody has, that they think they're dysfunctional or it is changeable, that the mind can be purified, because that condition and that belief are contingent on conditions, and what practice is about is changing the conditions. So this is the extraordinary potential of the practice. So, you know, I think it's unavoidable that as you work through these, I mean, I've had experiences, what are traditionally called anatta experiences on retreat, that, I remember one with Stephen Kamala, and it took me a couple of years to find my balance after that experience. It was so disorienting because my mind couldn't get off how destabilizing it was to realize that I had always thought that myself and my relationship to the world was like this, and that was untrue. It was like this, okay? Once I got through that, then it just was a whole new thing. My practice just went, psh, it opened up because I suddenly understood a whole new possibility about practice that I didn't understand before. So we don't want to suppress the response that is difficult or shocking. We want to work through it. But once we work through that, my experience is that it organically opens up to the possibility if we don't close down, you know, and it becomes affirmative.
Cass, sorry, I don't want to take others.
Nope, but, no.
Cognitive contemplation of uncertainty. I mean, again, this sounds ghoulish, but the fact is every day I send my kids to school and this could, what you described, you know, a lot of things could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I could contemplate that. I could contemplate that a solar storm could hit. I could contemplate that a car could hit me crossing this. I mean, is that sort of contemplation, and there are positive conditionalities as well, right?
Like, yep.
You know, as well, if somebody smiles at me, it makes me happy, or somebody says something nice to me, it makes me happy. I mean, is contemplating that fruitful, do you think, in terms of informing practice?
Okay, so I'm going to relate this to the idea of there being a map, okay? So just immediately when I hear that question, what I go to is that in the four fields or foundations of mindfulness, the first field is about the body, and there are the cemetery contemplations,
yes.
Right? Which are about the conditionality and dependency of my body and my consciousness and my life, right? So that is one piece. So it's not like, well, gee, that's going to be my practice. It's like, that's one part of practice. So for me, getting to Varanasi and getting to the Burning Ghats from a very young age was like, I knew that was somehow, just instinctively, I mean, this is like when I was a teenager, that I had to go to Varanasi and sit at the Burning Ghats. And so when I had the opportunity to do that, and I've done it twice, it's just phenomenal, you know. And it wasn't ghoulish, and it wasn't a downer in any at all. It was inspiring. It was inspirational. So it's the state of mind that we bring into this. So if we bring openness and curiosity, you know, which traditionally is considered right effort and investigation, that there is a state of mind that you bring to the thing, then it acts as, it sets parameters for the way you engage it. So if I'm not doing it with right effort and investigation, I go in and I think about you know, the sun's going to burn up the earth. This is what I thought. I wake up, the earth is going to burn up, and my grandson and my daughter in Hawaii are in Hawaii, and I'm not going to see them. It's just like, oh, you know, just like this wave coming over me, you know. But then it's like, okay, just like in sitting, just allow it to settle. Okay, what is right effort and right investigation in this moment? Okay, open to it. Bring some curiosity to it, and then suddenly it becomes something else again. So that's the closest I can get. Does that help?
Yep. So.
So are there any other questions about the earth burning up? Or yes. Yeah, you know, actually, traditionally, if you go like to the what they call the Abhidhamma, which is this very sophisticated analysis of experience that was put together after the Buddha, but they have I think there's 18 different kinds of causes, mm-hmm. one of which is proximate, mm-hmm. you know. But you know that's really not what my talk is about. You know, it's much more general than that. That the whole practice is based on it is a psychology of causation. You know, that nothing happens by itself. No experience, and nothing that you see is independent by itself. It's based on this causation principle. So that's one of the huge things that eventually we all get to with practice, is starting to see that and feel it and work with it. Yeah. Okay, so I'd like to thank all of you for coming tonight. You know, particularly in the environment and cultural and political environment in our country right now, the fact that there any human being who is interested in these teachings and looking at them, I think there's something special about that. And it's such a gift to us and everybody around us. So I want to thank you for coming. I want to thank Sarabella for being a member of our community, and all of us wish you the very best, and I really do hope that that you come back, you visit, or that we get there. Maybe all of us will do a little trip together. and you know, in some very real way, which I believe may all of our good intentions and efforts tonight contribute to lessening suffering in the world. Okay, so thank you very much.